KZSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an associate professor at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Thank you for joining me today on the show. Today I'm excited to have back return guest Alex Wright, author of the new book, Cataloging the World, Paul Otley and the Birth of the Information Age. Alex was an early guest on Hearsay Culture back when the show began. I should have looked it up, but it was early, several years ago. And he previously wrote the book Glut, Mastering Information Through the Ages. And in Cataloging the World, Alex takes a close look at an individual whose name I hadn't heard of prior to seeing his book, Paul Otley, who lived in the late 19th century and through ultimately through World War II, and focused on, as the title of the book suggests, a method for organizing all of the world's information. He was an interesting character for a lot of reasons we're going to talk about today, but primary among them is that he had a very sophisticated system of organizing all types of information, not just books as we know them, but magazines and newspaper clippings and souvenirs and other items in a system that was built upon the Dewey system, but far beyond that. Also, quite remarkably, as Alex unearthed in his research, he wrote about a system of organizing information and sharing information that eerily looks a lot like the Internet, but he wrote these things decades ago, in the early part of the 20th century, primarily. And so Otley is someone who, having been born and raised in Belgium, created a system and actually did create a library where he attempted this modest goal of organizing, as the title suggests, right, all of the world's information. And he, in his process of doing this, encountered a number of very, today even known, individuals ranging from Andrew Carnegie through World War II and his dealings with Nazi Germany. Through the book, Alex has done painstaking research in sources that we're going to talk about a bit, because there's quite a bit of drawings that Otley put together that, to me, from my IP perspective, some of these look a lot like patent application type stuff, but very detailed drawings of classification systems and of methods of cataloging information. In fact, as Paul, as Alex points out, in the introduction of the book, Nazi Germany took a very strong interest, particularly in his card catalog. Sadly, by virtue of the fact that this book is one that covers an individual who we don't know too well, much of Otley's archive was destroyed by both, it appears, and we'll talk about a bit this too, both perhaps the Belgian government, but then much more specifically by Nazi Germany as they overran Belgium. And so we don't have a lot left of Otley's materials, and what does exist, as Alex writes about, was found in a storage closet in a subway system in Belgium, which is just quite remarkable, although anyone who's been in the New York City subway system might not be too surprised that you might find odd things behind locked doors in the New York City subway, and in other libraries, but largely forgotten. And so this book is really fascinating, both as a history of this individual whose work is highly relevant today, but also as a tracing of what we mean by information gathering, information archiving, and information organization. And so our discussion today with Alex is not just going to be about the life and work of Paul Otley, but also about what we might take from his work today in 2014, and we're recording, in fact, in June of 2014, in July 2014, at a time where we are now, of course, dealing with many of these issues with Supreme Court decisions involving Aereo and questions of how we share information, as well as a variety of issues on the international stage with regard to IP law and cataloging information. Not to mention, of course, the government's work through the NSA and the leaks by Edward Snowden, seeking to do a lot of different things, both legal and perhaps illegal, with all the information we share on the Internet. So this book, this work, it should be of interest to both historians and the technologists, and I'm excited to have Alex joining us today. By way of very brief background, Alex, who is joining us via Skype from from Brooklyn, is a writer and researcher and designer who has written both this book and Glut, who I mentioned earlier. He previously wrote and worked for the New York Times. He's also written for The Atlantic, The Believer, Salon, Wilson Quarterly, Christian Science Monitor, Harvard Magazine, and others. He is currently working at Etsy in Brooklyn. He's a graduate faculty member at the School of Visual Arts MFA program in interaction design. He was also director of the user experience at the New York Times, where he previously worked. He is someone whose work, I think, is again touches directly on exactly what we focus on hearsay culture. And so I'm very excited to have him join us today on the show. Alex, thanks for being here today on Hearsay Culture.
Hi, Dave. Thanks for having me, and thanks for the nice introduction. So it's great to be here again.
So let's start off, Alex, with we talked last time about your background, and I think listeners can go to that podcast if they want to get more of that detail. So let's dive into this core question, which is why Paul Otellet?
Well, you know, he's an interesting character, and as you say, he's not very well known, and it seems to me that, you know, there's a lot he has to tell us today, and I think he's one of these people who, you know, really faded from view for a long time. I mean, he was kind of moderately known in his era. He was actually, interacted with a lot of fairly well-known people back in the 1920s and 30s especially. But then after the World War II, he really kind of faded from view. He died in 1944, right at the tail end of the war. And, you know, his work largely has not been translated into English, with a few exceptions. And, his reputation really just languished for a long time. And I think part of that is because, you know, he was working in Belgium right in the cusp of the war. And after the war, you know, the nation of Belgium had other things on its mind, like rebuilding the country. Meanwhile, he had passed away and was sort of, his work, a lot of it, as you mentioned, some of it was, you know, scattered hither and yon into different archives. Some of it did actually end up in a, you know, in the corner of a subway station in Brussels. Some of it sat basically moldering in an office for about 20 years until, a grad student named Boyd Rayward kind of picked up his paper trail and tracked him down and started to do some research. But, I think that's part of the answer. It's all, you know, and the fact that he wrote in French and hasn't been for the most part, picked up by English audiences. But I think part of it is also that, you know, if you really look at the conventional history of computing and the internet, you know, really that story is traditionally told from a very Anglo-American perspective. Like, there's this whole kind of mythology of Silicon Valley that traces, you know, the roots of the present day internet through people like Doug Engelbart, who worked at Stanford Research Institute in the 1960s, and even going further back, JCR Licklider, who actually, funded a lot of Engelbart's work. He was an active one of the people who played a key role in the establishment of the DARPANET, the Defense Department Network Initiative, that was the precursor to the internet. And then even further back, people like Benjamin Bush, who wrote a famous essay called As We May Think, that appeared in the Atlantic Monthly in 1945. That's kind of the traditional storyline that computer historians look at when they talk about, like, how the internet came to be. But I think it misses an important part of the story. And that story is not just about Paul Otellet, but it's about, I think, this sort of deeper lineage of thought that doesn't necessarily have a lot to do with computer science. I think there's a tendency, because we live in an era where the high-tech industry is very influential, and a lot of us spend our time interacting with these devices now, that we tend to look at, you know, the questions that surround the flow of information and the organizing of information through the lens of computer science. But if you think about it, there's a much deeper heritage that goes, you know, way back into human history of people who have looked at this question of how do we organize, you know, large bodies of information for a library or for a society at large, or in some cases for, you know, looking at it from a more global perspective. You can go back and look at the Library at Alexandria, for example, as a kind of early avatar of, like, an attempt to organize the world's information. And over the years, you know, there have been other people who sort of approached that problem. There was a guy I mentioned in the book named Conrad Gessner, who worked in the 1500s. He was a Swiss naturalist, and he also tried to create a what he called a bibliotheca universalis, a universal catalog of all the world's information. At different points in history, you know, there have been other attempts at really looking at the question of how do you organize information en masse. So I look at Atlee as part of that lineage, and I think it's a stream of thought that doesn't get as much attention as I think it deserves, because people were really looking at these questions in a different context that wasn't necessarily shaped by computers, but they were looking at the problem of people creating more and more information than any one person could really ever keep track of, and how do you design systems to support that? And that's where I think Atlee is particularly interesting, is because he was working at a very interesting point in history where, you know, he was steeped in that whole heritage. He himself had been a librarian and a bibliographer, and from an early age had been very interested in this question of organizing information. He had started designing his own library cataloging system when he was a teenager, and just had a real passion for this question of cataloging and classifying information. And he was working in a particular time when the issue of sort of what we might today call information overload was really starting to come into focus. And the reasons for that are, partly to do with the Industrial Revolution. By the late 19th century, when Atlee was sort of coming of age, you were starting to see the industrialization of the printing press, and at the same time, you were seeing an increasingly literate population, especially in Western Europe and North America, where you had a growing appetite for published information, and more and more people able to read, and the technologies of producing that information were becoming more efficient. And what Atlee saw early on was that, this problem was going to come to a head. The people were now churning, there was now so much information being churned out. We were starting to see daily newspapers and popular magazines and novels, Dickens and things like that. There really wasn't, up until the, say, mid-19th century, books were still pretty expensive, and the volume of information being produced was somewhat limited. But Atlee saw that this was really starting to change, and he felt like we needed a more sophisticated system for managing all of that intellectual output. And he was, working at a particular point in the years, like really leading up to the, the early days of the computer industry taking shape, that, there were a lot of kind of precursor technologies that he was starting to look at, over the course of his career, like things like, the telegraph, radio, television, microfilm. He saw all these kind of technologies kind of starting to coalesce, and he just started to glimpse the possibility that they might eventually take shape as some new form that would eventually sort of manifest as a network that would be globally available, where people could consume information from all over the place. So he just kind of saw these trends converging, a bit sooner than most other people, and I think for that reason he's interesting, because he saw some of the trends that were shaping the sort of present day information age, but he was looking at them without the lens of computer science. So I think in that sense it gives us kind of a fresh perspective for looking at some of these problems.
And Alex, as you talk about in the book, I mean, Atlee was like all of us, flawed. You also don't make the claim in the book, which is somewhat unusual in books like this. You don't make the claim that Atlee is the single most important human being on the face of the earth for whatever the given topic is, which is refreshing. At the same time, he was clearly was influential in his time, and there's definitely a lot that we can take from his work. One of the interesting things is, as we dive into this, and I'm gonna pull some quotes later on from his writing, and also a great question that you ask, which we will lead up to, which is what we take from this. But let's start here. I mean, Atlee, throughout the book, you point out phrases and names that he developed to describe these issues of information archival archiving activity and organization. So let's start with the name of his library and where that comes from and what it means.
Well, so initially, when he first started this project, it was in the 1890s, and he worked with, it was just, soon after he had worked as a lawyer, he actually began to collaborate with a a colleague who he had met when he was a lawyer.
Which he actually hated, by the way. I should, this being a show about law, I should point out, you pulled the quote where he said, God, all this procedure, and I'm paraphrasing. So for the lawyers listening, he was not a fan, at least, of our profession. But anyway, I'm sorry, go on.
No, you're right. He decided he had a short-lived career as a lawyer, and I think he was sort of, prompted into it by his father, who was a very successful industrialist and wanted somebody who would sort of, manage the family's affairs going forward, and he felt like the law would be a good career for his son, but it was never Paul's passion, certainly, and he was pretty miserable doing it for the first couple of years. But interestingly, though, I don't think any of what he later accomplished would necessarily, I think actually his experience as a lawyer was deeply influential, and probably things would have turned out quite differently, and it's very possible he might not have accomplished what he did if he had not had that initial experience working in the law, partly because one of the first projects he worked on in the law, he worked for a Belgian lawyer, a guy named Edmond Picard, who was a very famous Belgian lawyer, and I believe senator at one point, who had Otley work on this project with another of his lawyers, a guy named Henri Lafontaine, to create a compendium of all Belgian law. It was basically an attempt to create, I think it was called the Pandect Belg or something, and it was basically an attempt to create a catalog of all Belgian law. And so it was a big, laborious project, and put in a couple of years working on that. And in that project was where he first began to work with this guy, Henri Lafontaine, who went on to become his collaborator over the course of most of his career on his much more ambitious projects that followed. It was coming out of that project that he and Lafontaine realized they had a shared interest in this question of how do you create usable indexes of large collections of information. So they moved on from that project to work on creating a bibliography around sociological literature. And then they expanded from there into looking at other topics and thinking through how could they develop tools that would help researchers or scholars working in these particular domains to master the growing mountain of information that was being produced. They basically saw that there was so much scholarly information being generated. There were all these international associations forming, like scholarly associations, legal associations, and so forth, and it was just leading to this big outpouring of information. And so eventually what they did was they expanded the scope of their project to encompass all categories of information. And this was the genesis of what they came to call the universal bibliography. Mm-hmm. And it was about this time that Otley decided to leave the law behind and focus on this as really his main project. And he and Lafontaine basically spent a good chunk of the 1890s developing this sort of prototype of what they hoped would be a universal catalog of all the information that had ever been published in the world. So they started with looking at books and trying to develop a giant card catalog where they wanted to take every book that they could find a record of and catalog it, on a card and then put that into this growing card catalog, which eventually expanded to consist of 15 million individual entries. It took, decades for them to get there. But they managed to, after a couple of years, they managed to gain some traction for this project. It helped that Lafontaine, Otley's partner, won a seat in the Belgian Senate and was able to use his government contacts to help secure funding for the project. So they were able to get this essentially kind of a grant from the Belgian government. They were able to hire a staff and really organize this effort. They also demonstrated an early prototype of the project at the famous Paris World's Fair of 1900, where it got quite a bit of attention. They actually won like a grand prize at the fair for the project and got quite a bit of publicity that way. And by the early 1900s, it was really starting to take off. They at one point they launched a service that would let you send in a query via telegraph for a fee. And so anybody could basically a search engine. You could send in a question and say, I'm looking for information about topic X. And their staff would then go into the catalog, retrieve that information, and telegraph it back to you. Like using a search engine. As that effort kind of progressed, all they started to think a little more broadly about what this could be, you know, trying to think in terms of, you know, a more inclusive set of information that went beyond books, but to include, for example, newspapers. He wanted to create a universal archive of newspapers. He started to look at the question of how do you archive things like audio recordings, films, photographs, posters, and he just started to kind of mushroom. And eventually, he, partly in as a result of some correspondence and later more direct collaboration he had with people like a guy named Patrick Geddes, who was a well-known Scottish sociologist, and some other folks, he started to think in terms of, you know, not just a library catalog, but actually looking at envisioning this as part of a bigger cultural institution, which would also include, for example, a large museum, a global museum that would be, you know, not a traditional kind of museum that just has a bunch of kind of artifacts and curios, but something that would be more like a kind of teaching museum where you could come in and learn about a topic like math or the history of Spain or, you know, astronomy. And he saw that as, basically he saw the opportunity to use the museum as a sort of expression of this universal catalog as well, so that you could use the museum sort of exhibits as an interface, if you will, into a topic area, which you could then drill down deeper into using the catalog and the classification scheme that he developed. So as that vision sort of progressed, he began to call it, he began to call it the Palais Mondial, the World Palace. That's what he called this museum, which had the universal bibliography within it. And later he started, as his vision evolved further, and he started to see an even more kind of inclusive, integrated media landscape taking shape, he changed its name again and began to refer to it as the Mundaneum, which is actually basically a made-up word. It's vaguely Latin, but it's, so it's hard to say what it means exactly, but it implies kind of a global, you know, the Latin root mundus, I guess, would mean world or globe. And so it's sort of like the world institution, sort of, I guess would be a rough description, you know, very loose translation of what I think he was going for. So ultimately, when he, by the later part of his career, when he really started to talk, you know, in prophetic visionary terms about this global network, that could be a universal information clearinghouse, he began to refer to that as the Mundaneum, which I think is, you know, in some ways, and certainly anticipates, what the internet would eventually become.
We're chatting with Alex Wright, author of the book Cataloging the World, Paul Otley and the Birth of the Information Age, as recently published by Oxford University Press. You know, you got there, Alex, to a few questions I was going to ask you about with regard to what, in fact, Otley did. And I hate the word predict because it suggests that he knew the internet was coming. And I don't think that you don't suggest that. And I don't think that we don't know, but it doesn't seem like he did it. But there's a lot of overlaps between the notion of people being able to access from a distance information that is cataloged well. And one of the, you know, certainly not modest things that Otley did was literally refer to redefine the word book. And so perhaps you could talk a bit about that, which connects to, I think, a really interesting concept of a person working in this library called a documentalist. So what did Otley mean by the word book, and what is a documentalist?
Sure. So, yeah, Otley thought, you know, really deeply about the forms that information could take. And even though he himself, you know, had been a librarian and, you know, had grown up sort of steeped in books and was very invested in kind of book culture, he also felt like the traditional form of the book, you know, a set of rectangular pages, you know, glued together and bound between covers, was really a very limiting form. And he felt that it had, in some ways, outlived its usefulness, that it was really a legacy kind of technology that he felt was ripe for reinvention. Basically, his his philosophy was that, you know, the libraries traditionally had been, you know, so fixated on this particular form of the book that they had designed all these systems that he felt were solving the wrong problem. They were basically trying to, you know, help people find a book sitting on a shelf. And he saw that as, you know, more and more books were being produced, that just wasn't enough. There were too many books for that to be useful anymore. Maybe at some point that had been, you know, enough. But he felt like what the world really needed was a system that went deeper than that. And the classification scheme that he developed, it's called the Universal Decimal Classification, was really an attempt to get inside the covers of books and try to extract their contents. You know, in the same way you could say that like a search engine today, you know, when you have digital text, can get in there and sort of get inside, you can search inside a book. You know, if you go to Amazon or Google, you can like tease out things that are inside there. So he kind of had that thought, but the way he wanted to do that, he had no concept of like keyword searching. What he wanted to do was create a very sophisticated indexing system so that you could really, pinpoint bits of information in any given text, and he had a whole framework for describing, you know, what kinds of information you might find. Like some things are facts, some things are interpretations of facts, some things are, you know, sources that are cited or what have you. And he had a whole kind of vocabulary for describing that, and then also for describing the links between topics, so that you could sort of cross-reference one book to another book, and synthesize that information, and then express that relationship. And perhaps add to it in a new way and create a kind of new, a document on top, you know, that synthesizes other documents. So that particular activity is what he saw as the role of what he called the documentalist. He later coined another interesting term, bibliologist. And the idea is these are people who are, you know, expertly trained catalogers whose job is to, you know, really carefully analyze the contents of a book or a document and tease out the relevant facts and then draw connections between other documents and create sort of new forms of information that could then be aggregated and further synthesized. So he saw that as a very important role, as sort of the professional reader slash indexer slash synthesizer. So that's a big part of it. But in terms of the book itself, he also saw that, you know, as more and more types of media were taking shape, he felt like, you know, the definition of a book needed to expand, not to include not just, you know, traditional bound books, but radio, television, you know, phonograph recordings, all those things he thought over time would converge into what he called the new book, which would be the form that would emerge as all these different expressions of human knowledge would take shape. He ideally hoped for what he called the universal book to take shape, but basically the sort of meta book that would encompass all of the other books and other types of information all into one kind of fluid, globally accessible environment. So his definition of the book, you know, evolved to something that was really quite expansive and inclusive.
We're chatting with Alex Wright, author of the book Cataloging the World, Paul Otley and the Birth of the Information Age, on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to the show regularly, you know that KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways you can make a donation to KZSU. You could email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu, or you can go to our webpage at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, hope that you continue to keep listening to the station and to the show. So let's, you know, it's amazing stuff. And one of the interesting themes, if you will, that runs through your take on Otley and based upon a research you did, is the influence that he had when he was younger, with regard to Belgian activities in the Congo, and wars and colonialization and so forth. And it seems like that his observation of those events heavily influenced his thinking on information categorization and flow and the goals of this project. So perhaps you could talk a bit about that and his connection between that and his consistent statement of both pacifism and also a fair amount of arrogance and what we would call today racism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, Otley was certainly a product of his time, and he was living in, you know, in Belgium in the late 19th century when Belgium was really first, kind of flexing its muscles and establishing its colonial presence in the Congo, which, if you ever read anything about the history of the Congo, it's quite a dark chapter, you know, in the history of Belgium and the Congo. If you ever read Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness, there's also a great book called King Leopold's Ghost that gets into really some of the atrocities that were going on in the Congo during this colonial period. But, Otley's personal history is sort of bound up in an interesting way with what happened in the Congo. His father, Edward Otley, who was, as I mentioned, was a fairly prominent industrialist, had actually financed the first private Belgian expedition to the Congo, before it became a colony of Belgium. And then in Otley himself, actually, his first published book was actually about the Congo, or he published a pamphlet with his own point of view on the question of the Congo. He was actually advocating that African Americans in the United States should be repatriated to the Congo to help them, advance their culture, which is, you know, at the time was not a particularly new idea. It had been proposed actually by quite a few Americans as well. But he had a very, you know, had an interest in the Congo that had been shaped by, I think, early exposure to the topic. But to put it in context a little bit, you know, Otley's, I think his kind of interest in that topic was shaped by a number of things, you know, beyond just his personal history. He was also a big believer in a philosophy known as positivism. It was a guy named Auguste Lecomte had kind of first articulated this idea, and Otley was a firm believer in it. And it was basically this notion that, the notion that humanity is in a constant process of evolution, both biological evolution, but also social and political evolution, and that different cultures are, you know, at various stages of that evolutionary process. And, you know, in some ways you could say that point, that philosophy does play into a kind of imperialist point of view, this notion that you can, you know, take a so-called less developed country and help them, progress up that ladder. But it was very much, you know, part of Otley's worldview, and that worldview really shaped his approach to this project of classifying the world's information. He felt that, there was a close relationship between political and social progress and the organization of information. And it maybe takes a little bit of explaining. Basically, the philosophy suggests that humanity moves through different stages, and the stages in the positivist kind of worldview suggest that human society start at a phase of being very kind of theistic cultures where they rely on religious institutions and belief systems to sort of constrain their behavior, and that eventually those systems are supplanted by more secular state governments that enforce legal codes that then kind of substitute for some of that, to serve some of that same role, but also help ensure more individual liberty and the protection of intellectual freedom and individual rights. Felt like that was sort of the second stage. And then the third stage in this evolution in the positivist worldview is that eventually humanity, progresses to a stage beyond nation states and that kind of legal constraint system to a more enlightened place where people are self-governed in a way. In his view, that state comes about when there's universal access to knowledge, when human understanding has progressed to a certain point where people sort of understand things in the same way, that there is this And there's underlying all this, this kind of, you could say, sort of culturally imperialist view that it's possible to have a single universal truth that everyone agrees on, certainly would fly in the face of our probably more contemporary understanding of, you know, a more relativistic view of things. But from his point of view, you know, that was just a natural progression, and that eventually people could, you could get to the point where societies could progress to a kind of post-national state, a kind of an idealist, ideal kind of enlightened society. And he saw his project of trying to classify the world's information as deeply bound up with that project, that if you could really provide a system and a classification framework for organizing all the world's information, you could just in some ways sort of disintermediate the roles of, you know, of nation states and other sort of institutional gatekeepers of knowledge, I guess you could say, and that there would be another kind of phase in human evolution where we might have a more harmonious system in place. And so his relationship with the, you know, with the Belgian Congo question kind of like is a reflection of that point of view. He felt that it was possible to, the Belgian, you know, had this kind of, you know, in the sort of typical kind of imperialist mindset that, you know, they could help the uplift the, you know, the, you know, this so-called, you know, less developed country, to help progress them along this ladder as well. But interestingly, in his later years, Utley was, you know, very involved in, the question of African liberation. He, as much as that all sounds like kind of a very imperialist point of view, he actually did a lot of good work in this area. In the 1920s, he organized one of the first African national congresses that took place in Belgium, and people like W.E.B. Du Bois came. He and Utley had a correspondence, he had quite a number of prominent you know, African leaders there, and it was quite controversial. There was quite a, because of Belgium's history in the Congo, he was really ostracized in some quarters for hosting that event. And it actually cost him quite a bit. He had a bit of a falling out with the Belgian government, in part because of that. Actually, for a while, lost funding for his project. But he you know, was a real progressive in some ways, even though at the same time he was, I think, bought into a lot of prevalent views, you know, that at the time that we might find to be distasteful today. But certainly, I think there's a fascinating story there about just the sort of context of the Belgian question, of the Belgian Congo question, and how that shaped Utley's worldview and how he sort of engaged with that whole topic over the course of his career.
So we're chatting with Alex Wright, author of the book Cataloging the World, Paul Utley and the Birth of the Information Age. You know, you alluded to it there, Alex, and I want to talk about it a little bit more because, you know, you can somewhat easily put Utley on the spectrum of utopian theorists, and you spend a good amount of time talking about the work of Le Corbusier and his influence on Utley and even, you know, to some degree, right, the broader influence on utopian theory. And through this, you know, through this idea, right, you know, modern technologists, right, the people that are credited with founding the internet and then, you know, its defenders and supporters are often accused of themselves being utopian, right? And as we turn towards, you know, a second iteration or third iteration of the internet, some of those very idealistic utopian predictions for how the internet was going to create world peace, and Utley himself was a pacifist, but the modern predictions, you know, have proven not necessarily to be the case. We're now dealing with the after effects of the Arab Spring, which you know, to which Twitter and the internet gets a lot of credit, but then the downsides of the instability that exists in some of those countries causes people to question it. And so my question is really this: you know, is it fair to put Utley in that category, if you will? And I'm the one drawing these bright lines of the, you know, technologists today who view technology as the solution to all problems, which some accuse of being arrogant, and the arrogance associated with some of those views. So, again, these are my words, not yours, but I'm curious to get your perspective on it. Is it fair to say that Utley is arrogant about the ability of information and sharing of information to be the world's cure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a really interesting parallel, and I think there's something to it. I'm not sure if, I would quite describe him as arrogant, but certainly he was a committed believer, in the gospel of, making information freely available. And I think he did have, very high hopes for the possibilities of creating a universally accessible information resource. And frankly, he was met with, some resistance and even ridicule in his day. I mean, he was, newspaper described him as like a holy fool or something, he was, people saw this kind of, this great, project that he was building, the Palais Mondial, and they, they saw this as just this kind of over the top, project, and they began to, some journalists began to, poke fun, and, they skewered him for trying to turn, one newspaper said that he and LaFontaine were trying to transform Brussels into a city of cards. And so, people did raise some, he was subject to some skepticism at the time. And I think he certainly, felt that he was, he was fighting the good fight against, that he had a vision that was far beyond where he felt most people were. But he certainly, I think it's fair to say that he maybe, overestimated the potential of, of this project for kind of bringing about world peace, and probably underestimated some of the real world hurdles that would be involved in really trying to, make something like this stick. But I think where I would differentiate him from sort of the present day generation of internet utopians is that, there are a couple of important differences. One is I think that a lot of the rhetoric around, the kind of disruptive revolutionary nature of the internet is very much kind of informed by, I would say, a very American, distrust of institutions and a strong belief in individual agency. A lot of the mythology of Silicon Valley involves like kind of iconoclastic figures like, Steve Jobs and, in the web, people like Ted Nelson, who had certainly, some brilliant ideas, but was also a very iconoclastic figure who was very distrustful of organizations and institutions. Utley was different. He put a lot of faith in institutions. He was a, big believer that part of this project that he proposed would involve bringing the world's institutions together in a sort of federation that would be a kind of like transnational, institution that would, operate under the auspices of a new world government. And, that's a very different vision from the, kind of anything goes, sort of almost libertarian ethos of the web today. I mean, I did believe in institutions and structure and systems. At the same time, he did, I think, share a lot of the utopianism and the idealism and the belief that this could all lead to a more enlightened state for humanity. But the way he saw that happening was really quite different from the sort of, free market individualism, individual-centered, energy that seems to, that fomented the internet revolution. He was very much a believer that this should all be organized and managed in an institutional way.
So, Alex, we're getting to the point now on the show where I start asking what I call the unfair questions.
Okay.
The questions that, you don't have time to answer in the relative luxury that you've had up to now, fully. But I ask the questions anyway because it's my show. And as a journalist, I think you can appreciate that. So one of the, another interesting, set of interactions that you discuss in the book are Otley's dealings with both private industry and industrialists as well as governments. And so you mentioned Leopold, but he also, Otley also at one point, toured Andrew Carnegie, through the library, in the 1910s. And you parallel, or I should say you parallel, maybe that's too strong, but you talk about, the Google today and, how Otley's work might parallel Google. But my question is really is about those interactions. You know, you point out the profit motive that exists and existed in information access and storage, both in the case of Carnegie, although Carnegie was obviously extremely generous and a benefactor and part of that robber baron ideal. There was a profit motive there, and of course Google is a profit making entity. So talk a little bit, and really by that I mean maybe in 3 or 4 minutes, the relationship that Atlee had with private industry and what we might take from it today.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think what's really interesting about Atlee's vision for the Mundaneum is that there was very little private enterprise happening in the system that he envisioned. He really saw this primarily as a non-profit sort of public sector initiative, and you know, and the main objective of which was to promote intellectual understanding and cooperation between governments and institutions, and basically trying to serve a, you know, the larger purpose of helping, you know, humanity as a whole progress in its understanding and in the way that people chose to live together. He did not really see it as a vehicle for doing business, particularly. He did, you know, it's probably worth noting, he did envision a kind of small role for bookstores, you know, thing. But he really saw it as primarily kind of a vehicle for the exchange of ideas and information, not so much for trafficking goods. He also initially really did not at all foresee the social aspects of it. You know, I think he would have been quite surprised to see how much of what the internet has turned out to be is now driven by social networking and you know, people taking their personal relationships online. That was not really something that figured into his vision at all. He did have a notion that people could perhaps participate in some ways, that there would be, like, if you, for example, decided to you know, watch a lecture or a performance, you know, through what he envisioned as kind of a live, you could say a live streaming video, that people might be able to applaud or kind of like things, but he certainly didn't envision that the social media as we see it today. But he did, you know, that said, he did have, you know, he certainly understood that things cost money, and he spent a lot of time himself fundraising. He, as you mentioned, did have a relationship with Andrew Carnegie. Carnegie actually came and visited him in Brussels and was very impressed, spoke very highly of, you know, was very impressed by what he saw and what Atlee presented to him, and actually did fund the project for quite a while. And so Atlee certainly benefited from that largesse. But ultimately, you know, he saw that in the grand scheme that he envisioned, he really saw that as something that would be supported by the world's governments. And he envisioned ultimately that the Mundaneum as being, you know, a network that would be supported by a new kind of post-national world government, sort of modeled loosely on the League of Nations, and headquartered in a new location that that he envisioned as a new world city that would be a kind of brand new sort of neutral location where the world governments could agree to come together and collaborate and for example, that's where he thought the Olympics could be hosted, and there could be an international university, and he also saw his universal catalog and his international museum as core components of that larger vision. You mentioned Le Corbusier. He collaborated with Le Corbusier on a design for that world city that they actually presented to the League of Nations in the 1930s, unsuccessfully, unfortunately, but they did actually get quite a bit of attention for it and exhibited it in Switzerland. And you know, really were very actively involved in trying to promote this idea of the network as, you know, as part and parcel of this much larger sort of international, collaboration. But again, you know, private enterprise was just not really something he really envisioned as such an important part of what would happen on the network. And in that sense, you know, he really didn't, see how it would all turn out. I mean, if you look at Google today, it's, you know, they're, you know, their mission as an organization is ostensibly to organize the world's information. You know, the way that they organize that information is sort of a trade secret, you know, at some level. There's a whole cottage industry of people trying to reverse engineer the Google search engine algorithm. Whereas for Atlee, he thought that his universal decimal classification was meant to be pretty transparent. The idea being that anybody could see how things were related to each other, and you wouldn't necessarily need, anything other than a knowledge of the classification system to sort of you know, explore any topic that you wanted to, and he hoped that it would all be free. So there's definitely an interesting contrast there.
We're chatting with Alex Wright, author of the book Cataloging the World, Paul Otley and the Birth of the Information Age, from Oxford University Press. That trade secret aspect, Alex, you know, it hits on, you know, the question of access information, which is one that we focused on heavily on hearsay culture, particularly in the last several years, given how law and other information is being held by private entities. And it kind of gets us to the question that you close the book prior to getting to conclusion with, that I want to now ask you. So it's always nice when my guests give me questions and I can ask them, and so I appreciate the help. So I'm just going to read this one verbatim. You say, Otley's work invites us to consider a simple question: whether the path to liberation requires maximum personal freedom of the kind that characterizes today's anything-goes internet, or whether humanity would find itself better served by pursuing liberation through the exertion of discipline. I think the question certainly refers to the doggedness with which Otley attempted to come up with very detailed ways of organizing information. But I'm going to throw this question back at you and ask you, as we close our interview, to give your answer to that question.
Hmm. Well, you're really putting me on the spot with this one. Yeah, I mean, I didn't, you know, I posed it as a question, but I will try to give you some sort of response. So it's I think
it's a very hard question. So yeah. I apologize for asking it.
No, that's okay. That's quite all right. I think what Otley does open up is, you know, that if we look at his work from the vantage point of the present day, where we see that the network as we know it is a very commercialized place, and a lot of it is driven by, you know, what happens on the internet is largely driven by corporate profit motives and by individual citizens sort of desire for self-expression and, in some cases for, seeking attention, you know, through whatever means that might be, through their social media or through just, you know, doing things that generate, you know, page views and likes and things like that. So I think that the question I try to pose then is, you know, is that really leading us towards a more enlightened place, you know, or is it leading us into a place that's more of a self-indulgent place, that is sort of, wrapped in sort of a sheen of personal freedom? What I sort of was trying to suggest, I guess, with that question is that maybe Otley, even though on the surface it might look like he has proposed, he proposed a very institutionally constrained system that seems to put a lot of power in the hands of sort of institutional knowledge bureaus and so-called gatekeepers of information. If you really look at the spirit that's underneath that, it really is a very hopeful vision in the sense that, you know, by perhaps creating some constraints, you know, that might help us sort of channel our energies and perhaps to, you know, establish some filters that could help us, you know, focus our attention towards a more of a the pursuit of intellectual inquiry and work, at least, perhaps create the possibility of working towards a more lasting understanding of things, as opposed to kind of the fleeting satisfactions of looking at your Facebook feed or what have you. It does seem to me to present a more hopeful vision of what things could be, and you know, this paradox of like maybe being able to find freedom within constraints. There's something I think interesting to ponder there, but you know, realistically, you know, is are we going to see Otley's vision prevail? You know, certainly not in the way that he described it, but I think, you know, a lot of us, at least speaking for myself, you know, when I look at the way things are playing out, where you see more and more of the activity that takes place on the internet being channeled through a handful of very increasingly powerful corporate players, you know, it seems to me that it's maybe a good time for us to step back and reflect on, you know, an alternate vision of how things could be that maybe presents a more hopeful and less, less profit-driven kind of alternative conception of why we might be doing some of these things. So to me, that's why Otley is inspirational, not so much for the mechanics of how his vision would work, but just more for the underlying motivation that he really saw his version of the network as really a vehicle for social and intellectual progress.
Alex Wright, author of the book Cataloging the World, Paul Otellet, and the Birth of the Information Age. Really interesting and fun and insightful read. Like I said, an individual who I had not heard of until I read the book. And there's a lot more here that we could talk about, but I thank you for joining us today on the show. I look forward to having you back on. I don't know if you want to share it. Speaking of trade secrets, any new books or projects that you're working on now that you want to mention, or we can simply end by saying thank you for being here.
Well, I have, several ideas percolating, but nothing I'm quite ready to talk about just yet, but stay tuned.
Well, fair enough. So long as they fall broadly in the world of technology and intellectual property, just consider yourself having a standing invitation. Alex, thank you for joining.
Come back sometime.
I look forward to
having me again.
Thank you. A pleasure having you on the show. As always, you have a number of ways you can listen to Hearsay Culture. This quarter, the show will be on Wednesdays at 2 p.m. Pacific time at kzsu.stanford.edu. You can stream the show. But you can also get the show via podcast by going to either hearsayculture.com, where you can get all 215-plus previous shows, as well as the upcoming schedule. You can also get the show by going to the Center for Internet Society at Stanford's webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu, or by going to the iTunes page for CIS, where you can also get all of the other guests and other events that occur at CIS. As always, I welcome your comments, suggestions, and feedback at dave@hearsayculture.com. We're recording the show on July 3rd, 2014. I'm going to be posting later today the entire schedule for this summer quarter on KZSU, but I'm very excited about the guests that I'm going to be having on, Alex being among them, but other guests that are focusing on issues ranging from a backlash involving social media to the right to know, to First Amendment rights on the Internet, and questions involving big data and how government uses it. So very exciting stuff this quarter. Again, I thank you for listening. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.